I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. The topic of child and adolescent sexual abuse has not left the headlines in quite some time, but for many victims, it remains an issue that is shrouded in shame and silence. Brisa de Angulo was a victim of child sexual abuse in her native Bolivia and has since made it her mission to change the culture of silence and the law in Bolivia. She has founded a center that offers both therapy and legal services to children and adolescents that have experienced sexual abuse, and she joins us today together with her husband Palmer Parker to discuss her work and mission. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Brisa, you grew up in Bolivia. Describe your childhood and your family.
Well, my parents have always been involved in working with the rural communities and impoverished communities, so we traveled a lot growing up. We lived in Ecuador for a while and in Colombia, and then when I was about 2 years old, I arrived to Bolivia where I grew up. My parents started a clinic in one of the poorest communities in Bolivia, and growing up, we saw a lot of child abuse and neglect, and I have always been fascinated with trying to make a difference. And when I was about 7 years old, I was homeschooled, and I used to see the kids in my community come to my house with hair ripped out of their heads because the teacher had spanked them because they didn't do their homework, they didn't understand. And so it was my dream at that age to start a school, and so I would bring the little kids to my house and kind of help them do their homework. And they were the same age or probably older, but I was always known as the teacher since very young. I taught my two little sisters how to read and write. And by the age of 14, after so much insisting of a school, we started a school for children. And we have over 250 children in the school right now who receive nonviolent education, and it has become a model for Bolivia as nonviolent education.
So you always were service-oriented, and your passion was always with children, to help children.
Yes, with children. I had a project for a little bit with the elderly, but my passion has been with the neglected population and the most vulnerable population, yes.
And then what happened to you?
Well, growing up, while I was teaching in the school, one of my cousins came to live with us. I call him ex-cousin because I can't even consider him as family. And he started raping me and sexual abusing my sisters. And that's when I became aware about problematic, that I was aware, but with all these myths that society have given us, that it's a stranger, that it's somewhere else. And that's when I started getting very interested on knowing what sexual abuse was.
And who did you tell when this first started happening?
Well, the way predators start working is putting the victim into what is called a web, and they're charming, and they try to create this environment where they make you believe that you are the one at fault, that you have done something to deserve it, that that you wanted it. And although he was almost in his 30s and I was just a young kid, he manipulated me so much to make me believe that it was my fault. So he continued repeatedly raping me and subjected me to physical abuse and other type of traumatic psychological traumas and everything for 8 months. And it was only when we came for vacation in the United States when I met my brothers, and my brothers read my diary and they found out what was going on. They couldn't understand so much what was going on, and that's when I first went to a psychologist and I broke the silence.
And your parents found out at that point?
Yes.
And what did they do about it?
Well, they knew that something was going on with me because I started suffering from anorexia. I had eating disorders. I was very depressive, very argumentative, very confrontational with them. And they had seen how I was coming with so much dreams and so much energy to change the world pretty much, and suddenly everything changed and they didn't know what was going on. So they knew something was going on, but they had absolutely no even clue what was going on next door, you know, next room.
And this cousin had access to your house, was invited in.
He was like an older brother to us. He came 4 days after my brothers left. We were very close with my brothers and sisters. So
they left to go to the U.S.?
Yeah, to study in the mm-hmm. U.S. And so he kind of replaced that brother emptiness, and he was like a brother. He ate with us. He did everything like a brother. My parents let him responsible of us whenever they had to leave. So it was part of a family.
Mm. And I want to bring your husband into the conversation as well, Parker Palmer. I'm watching you as you listen to this story, which I'm sure you've heard many times, mm-hmm. but I can see the pain on your face.
Yeah, it's difficult no matter how many times you hear it. And each time I listen to it, I experience it pretty much as the first time I'm hearing it. It never gets easier. But it is, I mean, I think the biggest thing that I see is just the isolation that happens. You know, that the cousin isolated Brisa, and it destroyed part of her life there. And you know, as she'll tell you, it was with the support of her parents and a few other people who believed in her that helped her regain strength. And it is difficult.
Yeah. And Brisa, you were how old when this happened?
16. I just turned 16.
And then after this vacation, you returned to Bolivia. And then what did you try to do then?
Well, we tried to bring charges. And
you and your...
Me and my parents. Mm-hmm. Which is when all the story started, because no one wanted to take my case. We begged lawyers, we talked to prosecutors, we talked to everyone about what happened, and everyone was, it's an adolescent case, we can't take it, it's just a lost case. But we were able to start the prosecution process, but that was what I call the second wave of revictimization, because it was one person after another just either blaming me or not believing me or giving me their backs or some type saying that I had deserved what happened to me.
And how did this whole issue then affect your larger family? It must have come up in terms of, okay, now you're trying to press charges against a member of your family. So how did that change everything?
Right. I call them my ex-family. Not one person tried to support me. Everyone was against me, writing letters. My house was set on fire twice. It was stoned. There was a lot of threats. And from everyone of what I call my ex-family turned away, the extended one. So it's just my brother, sisters, my parents, and that's it pretty much. And the new family that we've created now.
And what year was that, just so we have a sense of that? This is not that long ago.
2002.
Yes. And did your parents ever consider leaving, or?
Oh yeah, they didn't want to return to Bolivia, and I told my dad. I remember the conversation, and I said, "If we don't return, we're letting him win, and I'm not willing to do that, and I'm not willing to do everything that I've dreamed go away because of what he did." And they have many times been ready to leave the country and just not go back. And I just can't. I can't see this happening to thousands of girls and close my eyes and pretend that this didn't happen.
And when you were going through this, the legal situation was still such that the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator could actually interrogate the victim in the courtroom?
Oh, yeah. The first trial, I've been subjected to three. And the first trial, one of the reasonings that it was, that it didn't go through was because I wasn't interrogated by my perpetrator. There was a law that said that perpetrators were allowed to interrogate the victims. So it could be a father interrogating a 3-4 year old girl. And that's when we took our case to the Constitutional Court and repealed that law.
So now that is no longer the case.
Yeah, that's no longer the case.
And you describe in one of the interviews I read with you, Brisa, you described how a girl approached you and thanked you for doing that.
Yeah, and it hasn't been one. It's been a lot of them, because the first thing that's read in every single case of sexual abuse is that law, to remind the judge that they can't let the perpetrator interrogate the girl.
Hmm. And how about the culture of silence? Do you think that has changed since 2002?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people, there's more awareness. There's people who have tried to do something about it, but I think that still there's a lot to do.
And when did you come to the U.S. then?
I left in 2003 when I was almost kidnapped by my ex-family and my life was at risk. And I came to live with the Mark and Terry Hippie. Which
was the trial over then?
Or? No, the trial's still open.
Okay. So they tried to kidnap you. Why?
Silence me. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of incest in my ex-family, from grandfather, uncles, cousins, everyone seems to. And they knew that if I break the silence, then that would be confronting a lot of what's going on. So they were trying to silence me.
Mm-hmm. So they tried to kidnap you, but weren't successful. And then what?
And then after many threats on the phone, on letters, the stoning of the house, my parents, we made the decision that I had to leave and come to the U.S. to the Hippies, which was a family that I barely knew. And I went to Montana for a year where my actual healing process started.
Mm. And what helped you heal?
The understanding and love. I had a lot of pain and anger at that moment. I hated the way that I had to leave everything I've known, my family, my culture, and being ripped apart. So the love and fit and understanding that this family gave me was the beginning. But I think that the most important thing I ever did was break the silence.
And how old were you then? About 17?
17.
Yeah. And your family wasn't able to come with you?
No.
So you see them often?
Yeah, I do. My brothers and sisters are studying here, and my parents continue doing work around the world, so they come here oftenly to see them, so yeah.
I want to hear more in a moment about the center you founded in Bolivia for children and adolescents who've been sexually abused, and want to talk more with your husband as well about the work you do every summer. We're joined today by Brisa De Angulo and Parker Palmer. They will be talking about their center, which is called Breeze of Hope in Bolivia. We'll talk more in a moment. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
Law can be an instrument of change. That's why the Widener Law Program is a practice-based legal education from a faculty of respected legal scholars and practitioners. Classroom learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, externships, trial simulations, and much more. And the Delaware campus, located in the heart of America's corporate capital and in close proximity to many of the nation's leading healthcare providers, is a place to focus on corporate and health law. Learn more at law.widener.edu. Widener Law supports WHYY.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Coming up on America Abroad.
In those post-Arab Spring countries where Islamists have won the majority of seats in parliament, they are now actually on the hook. They are responsible. They no longer have the luxury of sniping from the outside. They now have to deliver the goods.
Can they deliver the goods? The rise of the Islamists on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscoane, and we're talking about child sexual abuse in Bolivia with Brisa de Angulo and Parker Palmer, her husband. And Brisa has founded a center in Bolivia that helps child and adolescent victims of sexual abuse, and her husband is supporting her in that work, and together they've made that their mission. And Brisa, before our break, you told us how you came to the United States after having been sexually abused by a member of your family. You say they're your former family. Then you came here, but then your dream became to help others who had gone what you had gone through, the silence, the shame, and a legal system that did not support you. So when did the center come to be part of your life and your mission?
Well, we started the center in 2006, but before that, my dream was that no girl should go through what I went. I went through two different forensic exams, which were absolutely horrible, where there was a medical doctor with five of his male students, and they were all laughing while I was crying, begging them to at least go out after this traumatic experience. And prosecutors who blamed me for what was going on threatened me that if I had any lie, I was going to jail, that she was going to make sure that to put me in jail.
It was a woman?
It was a woman. And then judges who started blaming me because I didn't scream, or different process. Every single step was someone just telling me to be silent. And I made a promise to myself that I would not live a day without trying to prevent girls from going through what I went. And that's when we started the Center, A Breeze of Hope. I just intended it to be a small place where girls come, and all I could do was tell them, I believe in you, you're not alone, and there's not much I can do, but at least there's someone who trusts you. I never thought it was going to become as huge as it has, and had made so much changes as it has.
And you did that work from the U.S. and going back and forth?
Yes, back and forth.
And how did you find the money to start this?
Well, we didn't have the money, so we just had a one-room thing. And then we've had people who have joined the cause, and it's difficult. But anyone who wants to make a donation, their friends making $10 a month, $20, and that's how we have run it, and it's still there. And every year it's a crossing of the fingers to have people who want to help to continue doing what we're doing.
And where is the center located? And describe it for us. What does it look like?
It's located in Cochabamba, Bolivia, which is the center of Bolivia. And it's the only and first center who provides free psychological, social, legal, and medical services to children and adolescents who have been sexually abused. It's the only center in the country that provides these services to victims.
And Parker, when and where did you meet Brisa?
I met Brisa when I was a freshman in college.
Where?
Eastern University. It's a small liberal arts school out in St. David's, Pennsylvania. And the way I met her was she was talking about Bolivia, and we had decided to, she invited me to go down to Bolivia, and I said, I don't know. And then I went down eventually. I said, okay, I'll go. And we went down, and I got down there, and I just never decided I was not going to come back that summer. So I stayed down there the entire summer instead of the planned 2 weeks, and that's when it really started. I got involved that summer with CUBE,
which is the center.
Mm-hmm.
Please do say it in
in Spanish. It's Centro Una Brisa de Esperanza, and it means Center of a Breeze of Hope.
Breeze of Hope. All right. I was going to let you say that rather than me attempting it. And Parker, did you know that this issue was so much part of Brisa's life, that it was a package deal of sorts, her advocacy?
I did. From kind of the first day that I met her, it was obvious that she was very passionate about being involved with children who've been sexually abused, about advocating on their behalf, about changing just the legal system, the social structure surrounding it. And yeah, I knew from the first day, and I think that's one of the things that made me want to be part of it, was seeing her passion.
And this is a difficult issue in any country, and I think here we struggle with it, obviously, but there are places where people can go and victims have advocacy. What struck you the most when you came to Bolivia or just hearing Brisa's story?
I think the obstacles that she faced. That I know that that happens here, but I think what struck me the most was the severity of it. Just at every step of the legal process, I mean, everything that happened before with her ex-family, all the threats, and then what I was going to say was every step of the legal process, there was just re-victimization and more re-victimization, and there was no one there who said, I trust you, we believe you, we're going to do everything we can to make this process more comfortable for you, even though there are parts of it that will be difficult. That never happened.
Mm.
And I realized that the first summer I was down there, and I realized that's when I decided I wanted to go to law school, actually, was because I wanted to be able to be part of a movement that helps to change and reform systems. And that's where we're headed now.
You're both in law school now at Rutgers Camden in the law school there. And I want to invite people to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. If you have a question for Brisa or Parker about their work, or if you have an experience with this issue itself or want to talk about it in this country as well, please join the conversation. And Brisa, I've heard victims refer to this denial and the silence and the shame to, they've called it the second betrayal. So first you are betrayed because somebody you loved has abused you. And then you try to tell somebody and they don't believe you and then they shame you. So is it just the continued hurt and trauma?
Yeah, it's the second re-victimization. One thing that I was fascinated with was studying with the psychology, and I did my master's, and I study how the brain functions on child sexual abuse. And one of the most damaging thing about child sexual abuse and adolescent sexual abuse is the betrayal trauma. And it's the betrayal trauma from a person that you trusted, a person who was supposed to take care of you, and then comes the second betrayal trauma, which is society and anyone around you. And it just exacerbates everything that's happened and just solidifies what the perpetrator has done with the victim.
Now, you had the support of your immediate family.
Yes.
Your parents believed you. Your siblings protected you. What about the children who come to your center? Do they have anybody in their corner?
Well, we have the staff, which is for lawyers, for psychologists, who are mostly their family, who have become the family of these victims. And we also work a lot with parents to try to help them support their victims and provide education and show them that they need to support their child. So,
but I'm thinking for a lot of the children, the perpetrator may be the parent.
Right. And one of the first things we do when we receive a new case is find who can be your support system, but there's a lot that don't have anyone.
And do a lot of the victims want to go to court? Do you leave that up to them? Do you encourage them?
We encourage them, but we do leave them up to them because at the end of the day, they have to decide. But we do encourage them. I believe that being able to face your perpetrator and take the mask out is one of the biggest healings you can have. And that's why I went to law school, because it didn't matter how much I was doing with my psychology and therapy and all that. If there wasn't access to justice, it was stuck.
Well, and Parker and Brisa, you've done some research on this issue in Bolivia, and the numbers you've found are staggering. What did you find?
In 2009, for my thesis on Towson University, I did research with almost 4,000 students, where we found that 30% of girls are being sexually abused before the age of 18, and 1 out of 5 boys are being sexually abused before the age of 18, and 70% of them have never told anyone, and more than 50% said that the first time they've told anyone about sexual abuse was on the research. So it was just a very alarming statistic, which is pretty much similar to other statistics around the world. Even here in the United States, 1 out of every 3 girls and 1 out of every 5 boys.
Yeah. We have Ryan who wants to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Hi, Ryan. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How you doing? Wanted to say first, the speaker has an amazing story of perseverance, and I really admire how you pulled through what you've been through. But my question was, I had read online that for consent law, that Bolivia has the lowest or seemingly most deregulated age of consent law in the world, which is puberty, and that seems insane to me. And I was wondering if you know why this is and how the legal system seems structured to allow this sort of victimization to take place.
Parker, do you want to take that?
Yes.
Thank you, Ryan.
Well, one aspect of the research that I've conducted in Bolivia is right around the age of consent there, and the problem has its source in the family laws and the way that there's various provisions in the family law and the way they interact. The legal age for consent for marriage is 14 years for women, for young girls, is 14 years old. However, there is a provision that says if the young girl becomes pregnant before that age, then the marriage will be legal. So there's a provision that takes the floor out, and it really becomes a matter of puberty and your capacity to bear a child as a woman. And so at that point, that's where that we start to see that there really is no floor for the age of consent. And I think that's where the problem has its source in the law, is in the interaction of those family law provisions. And then it has larger repercussions in sexual abuse cases where consent starts to become an issue. And those laws, well, it's hard to explain the interaction of them, but the consent becomes an issue in the child sexual abuse case. And then there is also, in child sexual abuse cases, there's a provision in the criminal code that says if the perpetrator marries the victim, then the crime of rape as a matter of law is extinguished. And so if the child is pregnant from the rape, there is no floor to the age of consent. And so you can have a rapist marry a child who's younger than 14 years old under the law.
So this is deeply embedded in in the legal code.
Yes.
and everywhere else in the culture. That voice we just heard is Parker Palmer, together with his wife, Brisa de Angulo. They have founded a center called A Breeze of Hope, and they are working with children. The center is in Bolivia, and they are working with children and adolescents there who've been victims of sexual abuse, and this is a place where they can come for therapy, for legal advice, counseling, and all of those things. Now, Brisa, I've wondered, I read a lot of stories about you, and you described in some of them different interactions you've had with victims, and I'm wondering how you were able to carry all that suffering. You described one story about a baby that had been abused. You came in the room and there was a young mother with the baby, but actually the victim was the baby, who was 3 months old. And I'm wondering just how are you able to do this and tolerate it?
It's hard. I emotionally get drained. But at the same time, it's so rewarding to see that you can change a tear to a smile. It's when you see this brokenness and you can do something to create them to regain their wings, the satisfaction and the happiness that it creates has no price, and they are my strength to continue growing. And just seeing them going back to school, dreaming about their futures, wanting to change, it's the balancing part.
But where do these children go, especially Parker, if they have no advocates in their family? So where can they go? What happens to them?
From what I understand, the children, when they don't have an advocate, when they don't have a family support system, or they don't even have an extended support system of friends or anyone who will be there for them, a lot of times they just kind of disappear into the abusive family structure.
Mm-hmm.
They literally just disappear. We don't see them anymore. And I think one of the most difficult things that I personally have confronted is when the victims altogether disappear. You don't know where they are anymore. They're not there with the family, the abusive family, and they just have no one there. I mean, who knows what happens to some of these children? And I think that's the most difficult part of seeing the lack of support, is children disappear sometimes.
Brisa, what do you think would have happened to you if your former family would have been able to kidnap you as they tried?
I can't expect the worst from them. The levels of evilness that they have reached, I can expect anything.
Now, we are learning a lot about the kind of generational aspects of sexual abuse. So do you ever kind of try to find out about the perpetrators and whether they may have been abused and how to stop that cycle?
Yes, I have. And one thing that there's a myth is that most of the perpetrators who abuse is because they want to have sex or their sexual gratification. But the truth is, for them, is the sense of control and power and have a victim subjected to their manipulation. And to have one of their prides is to see how they can hide it to society and to see how they can be with the family of the victim and no one will realize that he's raping the victim. And I think that we as a society have the strongest way of prevention if we can prevent the perpetrator from doing that, from enjoying seeing how he can manipulate and be charming to everybody else and appear like he didn't do anything.
Mm. And if a child comes to your center and they don't have anywhere to go, what do you try to do for them so they can go on and grow up and continue school?
Well, we provide, like I said, it's a comprehensive center. So we find a place for them to stay, to live, if they don't have any support system. And we see them almost every day. We provide lunch there. So that after school, they come to eat lunch and they stay all afternoon with us doing therapeutic activities and interacting with other kids.
And how do they find you? How do they come to you?
Well, Kube has become really known. We have over 900 victims. We talked in almost every school. We give workshops in every school letting them know if you have been sexually abused, it's important to break the silence. And we pass around our phone number. We've talked in almost every TV channel, every radio station, just to let people know we're there. And then the prosecutors also send us cases.
So things have changed, if you're able to speak about this topic in schools and on television. So there is a greater openness now to talk about it?
It has been a huge change. The fact that every child can listen about this and know whether they have been sexual abused, because many of them don't even know that what's happening to them is sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm. Parker, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, as far as the prevention aspect goes, I think that the most important thing, which is all the interaction in the school, it targets that. Well, we can talk about it in a second.
All right. We're going to go. He heard the music coming up, so we'll take a short break and then we'll continue that thought, Parker. And Parker is joining us, Parker Palmer, along with his wife, Brisa De Angulo, and we're talking about child and adolescent sexual abuse, and we'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by the McCarter Theater Center in Princeton, presenting An Evening with Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series, on Friday, April 20th at 8 p.m. Presented in association with the Friends of the Princeton Public Library, An Evening with Alexander McCall Smith at McCarter Theater. Tickets and more information at 609-258-2787 or online at McCarter.org.
Baseball's back, and on the next Fresh Air, we explore the life of a major league catcher with Brad Ausmus. He'll tell us about nasty foul tips, how to call pitches, and collisions at the plate.
I was actually spun around, my helmet came flying off, and I was unconscious for about 5 or 10 seconds.
But did he hold on to the ball? We'll find out. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Does your town have an online patch news site? They tell you about everything from water main breaks to local elections, but can this hyper-local news experiment survive? Also, Marilyn Robinson, author of Housekeeping in Gilead, on her Idaho upbringing, her love of faith, and old American hymns. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Mascawain, and we're talking about child and adolescent sexual abuse in Bolivia with Brisa de Angulo and Parker Palmer, her husband. Together, they have an organization that they work in that helps other people who have experienced sexual abuse, and Brisa has started a center in Bolivia that helps people who have experienced this with therapy and legal services and so on. And Parker, before our break, you just wanted to make a point about prevention and how the culture has changed in Bolivia. So go on with that.
Well, CUBE as an organization in Bolivia has taken several steps to kind of encourage the breaking of the silence. And I think the overarching theme to their prevention strategies is breaking the silence, that's the most important thing, and that comes in with the efforts with the workshops at the school, is teaching the students and teaching really as many people as they can the importance of that. And then they take four other main approaches, and they're on the level of public policy, legal reform, effective prosecution, and also on education. And just a few things briefly about each one of those is public policy is about zero tolerance, that CUBE advocates kind of a zero tolerance approach.
And CUBE is the original name for your center, which we're calling Breeze of Hope. But
And they take a zero tolerance approach and they advocate that zero tolerance approach in schools and workplaces and to various organizations, and also just publicly declared support for victims so that it's known out in the public that if you break the silence, you'll have support. And then legal reform, that's just about trying to open up access to the courts and minimize the revictimization. And then also with prosecution, it's keeping the same prosecutor there. The same person who started the case finishes the case so that the victim becomes comfortable, and that can increase confidence in the victim. And then with education, it's really just letting children know their rights and knowing that they have a support system and that it's not their burden to protect themselves, that we as adults will assume that.
And where have you found allies in the process? Have you found people, politicians or other women, Brisa, who've helped you?
I think most of them have been NGO organizations, women activists in Bolivia. But most of it have been other adolescents and children.
And we're not talking about just girls. We have to make that clear.
Yes, we're not talking just about girls. There's a lot of boys who are also sexually abused.
Let's take another call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Carmen joining us. She's joining us from Westchester. Hi, Carmen. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question that sounds very much like the two people with whom you're speaking are entrenched in the literature surrounding childhood sexual abuse and the kind of impact psychologically and legally that can have, and yet I continue to hear them referring to those who are impacted by childhood sexual abuse as victims, victims, victims. Where are the survivors?
Brisa, is that a distinction that you make? Thank you, Carmen.
Thanks, Carmen. I think that's a very important thing. We refer to a person who's being victimized as a victim until they break the silence, and then they become survivors, and they start gaining control of their lives. And we do use the term survivors. A lot of people don't know that term, but as soon as someone breaks the silence, we start referring them as survivors.
And what kind of therapy services, we keep talking about that as well, at your center, children and adolescents can receive therapy. So what kind of services do you offer there?
We provide art therapy, music therapy, drums therapy, dance therapy, if I said that, group therapy, individual therapy, water therapy. So there's all this different types of therapy that they receive.
And what helps children heal, other than, you say, breaking the silence is important, finding that support system, but what helps children heal and grow after that?
I think the being able to meet other people who have gone through what they've gone and see them be able to overcome this, and they create their own support system among each other. And I think that therapy helps a lot in the process.
Let's take another call. We have Linda joining us. She is joining us from Cape May. Hi, Linda. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. First of all, to your two speakers, overwhelming admiration for what you're doing. I was listening to a prior caller that raised a question about the consent age
of consent,
14 in Bolivia. My question is this, that struck a chord with me. With so many global summits that we have going on, with whether it's environmental, whether it's drinking ages, whatever, has there ever, and I don't know if you have this answer, has there ever been an initiative globally to look at what is an appropriate global age for consent? It seems that, and to be honest, I was totally unaware in the country of Bolivia that this issue was so prevalent, and it's disturbing. But also, it's prevalent in so many other countries. And it seems that if our world leaders could at least get together and look at how many of our countries have this issue with young people, adolescents, that it might be a starting point where we could all look at it and see if we could come to a consensus of legal consent.
Okay, Linda, thank you so much for that call. I'm going to pose that question to Brisa. What's your take on that?
I completely agree with you. I think it's time for us to get together and say stop. And as you said, it's a global pandemic. It's not only in Bolivia, it's around the world that so many children are suffering. And I do agree that we need to get together as a world to come to a consensus. And one thing we did last week is took a thematic hearing at the Inter-American Commission, because our goal is try to work with the OAS and with the Inter-American community to come and raise these issues and come together with see what is appropriate for children and adolescents.
So you just mentioned you testified at a hearing of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, D.C., and one of the points that was made during this hearing was that the extent and intensity of prevalence of violence against women in Bolivia borders on femicide, is what was said. How describe that a little bit, why, or do you want to make that point, Parker?
Yeah, I can make that. The reason I think it was described as femicide is because the level of violence in general against women is incredibly high. And
domestic violence,
domestic
abuse.
Violence, just all kinds of violence, really. And child sexual abuse, adolescent sexual abuse is one of the severe forms of that violence. But it sits in a context of violence in general against women, and one of those types of violence against women is literally femicide, that women are murdered and by their spouses, by their partners. And I think that is why it was couched in those terms, because it is part of a larger problem.
And Brisa, you've talked a bit about the allies you found in your work in Bolivia. What about your enemies? Who is opposing the work, and what kind of threats have you received?
I have received a lot of threats, and a lot of people who have begged me not to go back because my life is at risk. But I just, I always tell them, if I ever die, I want to die doing what I believe I should be doing, and I'm not scared. And yeah, most of them are perpetrators and their families.
And do they write to you, or how do the threats manifest themselves?
Yeah, they send letters, they make phone calls. My perpetrator's out there, he's made phone calls and threats and said that he's going to find me. And so yeah, I receive them, I kind of am used to it.
How do you keep the center safe, the actual center where your children come? Parker,
well,
you're nodding.
I think one of the things that contributes to that is kind of the structure of the facility, that when you have to ring a bell to open to get in, and also where it's at. It's located right in the center of the city in a heavily trafficked area. So there's a lot of people around there, and that exposes it to the public. which I think is a really crucial element, that it's not isolated in the countryside somewhere where attacks on the center could happen.
Are you afraid for Brisa? Do you always go with her when
she goes? I worry, yes, and I do tag along, but at the same time, she knows how to take care of herself, and but I do worry.
What about your family, Brisa? Your parents are still in Bolivia?
Sometimes they're in Bolivia, sometimes they are here, and sometimes they're...
Are they at risk because of your work and you being so...
Well, they have become very advocates, so they've written about 20 books in the last 10 years about these topics, so they've become very advocates, and my whole family, it's just their passion, it's just what we're going to do, and that's what we're focused on.
Let's take another call. We have Jessica joining us from Camden. Hi, Jessica, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I have you on speaker. I'm actually a classmate of... Lisa and Parker's, and I wanted to just let them know that I'm very, I admire them very much, and that I think they're doing great work. I also wanted to ask where the name of the center came from. I always assumed it was named after Brisa.
It's called A Breeze of Hope, and in
Spanish, yeah, it's Una Brisa de Esperanza, and my name, Brisa, means breeze in English, so yeah, it was one of the reasons, and... that it started with that name, yes.
A Breeze of Hope. We also have Michael joining us, also from Rutgers Camden, so I'm assuming it might be yet another classmate. Hi, Michael, you're on Radio Times.
Hey, Brisa, Parker, and, obviously, thanks for having me on. Hey, guys.
Hey there, Mike.
I was actually going to bring up the international human rights piece that you guys spoke on recently, in the last couple minutes, and just point out that what's going on in Bolivia is not just, an ignorance of their own laws and not enforcing their own laws, but this is a violation of international human rights law. And I know you guys pointed out that you participated in the hearing last week in Washington, but could you be a little more particular about how this is a violation of international human rights law and not just a Bolivia issue?
Thank you, Michael. Parker?
Well, under international law, adolescents, children in general, have a lot of rights, and those include access to justice, the right to, being treated with dignity, also being their specific rights of being, the state has the obligation to protect children from physical and sexual abuse. And if you look at what's going on in Bolivia under that framework, they're failing in all of their obligations under international law. The children don't have access to justice. The state is not fulfilling its obligations to provide protection for the children. And when they are in the legal process, they're not receiving the type of humane treatment that they deserve. They're not receiving support.
And Brisa, how difficult is it to get attention for this problem in this country with all the suffering that's going on in the world? And
it's very difficult. It's a topic that a lot of people feel bad about and say it's really sad, and then they forget about it. And one of my dreams is that people can join and see that the life of these children have been destroyed forever, and all we can do is try to restore a little bit of that and be there around them. So it is hard, and not a lot of people like to talk about it. A lot of people get uncomfortable around the topic and prevent talking
about it.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that there are other very pressing problems in Bolivia.
Absolutely.
Set the scene a little bit for us, Parker. What are some other, I would think, poverty and...
I think, yes, that is one of the pressing issues, is the intense poverty in the country. There's also just political instability in general, the work situation. There's not a lot of jobs for people, and the jobs that there are don't pay well. And I think that all creates just an environment of stress in general. And then when you have all of these kind of overarching economic and political problems, sometimes the issue of sexual abuse just gets swept under the rug, and it's really sad when that happens. That in public meetings, it often gets subordinated to other issues, or it gets tagged on as just a subpart issue of another problem when it's not.
Mm-hmm. And Brisa, what are the main things that you believe will have to change in order for this issue to be better understood and for people to be better aware and for people to have more help?
I think the first thing is breaking the conspiracy of silence. Those of us who have experienced sexual abuse need to break the silence for our own healing, and those who have heard about it need to talk about it. We are only going to eradicate this if we can speak up. There's a story of this little girl who used to tell me that the perpetrators are like bats. They like to live in the darkness, and she said that she was like a cave, and every time she spoke up, it was like she was letting light go inside the cave to kill the perpetrator that was inside, so the bat. And that's how I see it. Only by opening our mouths and breaking the silence, we're going to bring light and not let bats live in caves. Mm.
And how has technology helped you or not in your cause? Are people active online? Is it not as accessible as it is here?
I'm personally not a very technology person, but I think that it has great potential. I mean, we have a webpage, abreezeofhope.org. I really don't know how to do it, but I would love to find someone who knows how to do this kind of stuff. I mean, help us do a great web page and get connected. And it's nice to see and find people who are willing to talk about this and support you about this, especially like the staff at Rutgers University. The teachers are just amazing. They are people who really care about you and who care about making a difference.
And we just have about a minute left. When you graduate from Rutgers, both of you, is your plan to stay here, continue working here, or are you planning to go back?
We're, like, people ask me where I'm from. I'm not from Bolivia. I'm not from Colombia. I'm not from the U.S. I'm a world citizen. So wherever there's need, I'm going to be there. So I'm just wanting to make a difference wherever I am. So where we're going to be, I don't know.
And what about you, Parker?
I largely feel the same way, that if I stay here, well, then I'm going to try my best to get involved. And if I go somewhere else, well, then I'll be involved there too.
Okay. So with that, we are going to have to close. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. That's Brisa De Angulo and her husband, Parker Palmer. And they have together founded a center called A Breeze of Hope, and that is in Bolivia. And right now they are both students here at